Chapter 2. Germans Around the World. Germans are an old people, but Germany is a relatively new nation. The German language goes back more than 1,000 years, longer than English, French, Spanish, or Italian, and Germans were recognized as a distinct people in the days of the Roman Empire. Yet it was 1871 before the numerous fragmented German states and principalities were united by Bismarck to form Germany as a state. But centuries before that, large-scale emigration of Germans had begun, first to destinations within Europe and later across the Atlantic. Even before they joined the great worldwide streams of emigration which followed the discovery of the Western Hemisphere, German peasants had settled in enclaves scattered through much of Eastern Europe during the Middle Ages. Authorities and rulers in these regions often encouraged these settlements by allowing these peasants to live under laws modeled after those of their homelands, rather than the laws and practices of Eastern Europe. Though called German law, these laws applied to all who lived in certain settlements, including settlements whose populations were not predominantly German. Many of these settlements absorbed into German culture some of the native inhabitants, with German land laws prevailing and creating more secure private property for peasants, with accompanying benefits of greater incentive-driven agricultural development more advanced than that generally prevailing in Eastern Europe. In short, Germans brought with them the cultural advantages of Western Europe into a generally more backward Eastern Europe. Polish, Czech, and Hungarian rulers welcomed German settlers into their lands for precisely this reason. Communities of German miners likewise spread down into the Balkans as mineral deposits were discovered in various parts of the region. Major urban centers in medieval Eastern Europe were typically dominated by Germans, not only demographically, but also culturally and economically, rather than by the indigenous peoples of the surrounding countryside. Before the year 1312, the official municipal records of Krakow were kept in German. That year, the change was made to Latin, and it would be another century before a majority of the city's population was Polish. German merchants spread through Eastern Europe and the Balkans, with Nuremburgers, for example, taking over the metal trade of Bohemia. Germans were also welcomed as formidable fighting men in the service of Eastern European rulers, and German artillerymen served in the armies of the Ottoman Empire. In addition, the Teutonic Order of Knights became a major military force in itself, conquering Prussia and engaging in warfare with Poland. Nor was German migration in Europe confined to Eastern Europe and the Balkans. German skilled craftsmen spread throughout Europe during the 15th, 16th, and 17th centuries. In the 15th century, many German craftsmen emigrated to Italy. Clockmaking was just one of the crafts in which Germans excelled. German clockmakers worked in Milan, Rome, and other Italian urban centers. French royalty imported German craftsmen to make clocks for them. As late as 1650, the French invited German clockmakers to Lyon, which was already a leading clockmaking center of Europe. In short, Germans were a major part of the worldwide and centuries-old process of diffusion of skills from where they were abundant to where they were more scarce, whether those skills were agricultural, commercial, military, or the skills of many artisan occupations. This role preceded both the age of transoceanic migrations and the era of industrial revolution, though both these epochs enhanced the worldwide role of Germans in spreading their skills to other countries and regions. Emigration was not simply a search for an outlet for skills that were in more demand elsewhere. There were also reasons to seek to escape the German homelands. By the 18th century, several successive generations of Germans had experienced almost unremitting warfare on their territory. The southwestern regions especially were repeatedly devastated by armies of various nationalities, the crops destroyed or requisitioned, the people robbed, pillaged, and tortured, entire towns destroyed by blast and fire, and industries and agriculture paralyzed by fear and uncertainty. During the Thirty Years' War, a single observer in the Palatinate counted 23 villages in flames in one day. Altogether, the Palatinate lost 4/5 of its inhabitants during that war. It is hardly surprising that emigration from the southwestern regions was particularly heavy in the 18th century. Rulers of various southern German principalities issued edicts designed to impede or forbid emigration, but these had little effect. Indeed, emigration increased in size and in the diversity of destinations. In 1709, about 15,000 Germans went to Britain, of whom nearly 4,000 settled in Ireland. In addition, 3,000 crossed the Atlantic to New York, and other 18th-century German immigrants settled in North Carolina. Pennsylvania became the principal American destination because of its religious toleration, which attracted especially various pacifist groups, such as the Mennonites, Amish, and Quakers. As early as 1745, there were an estimated 45,000 Germans living in Pennsylvania. About 30,000 Germans settled in Russia in the mid-1760s, and nearly 20,000 Germans immigrated to Hungary in 1770 alone. Origins as well as destinations changed during the 19th century. As late as 1834, virtually all German emigrants were still from the southwestern region. But a decade later, 5/6 of all German emigrants were from other regions. Half of the Germans who emigrated from 1816 to 1830 went to South America. But after 1830, about 90% went to the United States, on into the early 20th century. As of the early 19th century, the German states and principalities were essentially an agrarian world, where three-quarters of the population lived in villages and small towns. Such industry as textile manufacturing and the production of metal goods was carried on largely by artisans. However more technologically and economically advanced the Germans were as compared to the peoples of Eastern Europe, compared to the peoples of Western Europe, they were at that juncture followers rather than leaders in industry and, to some extent, in agriculture as well. More advanced and more scientific farming methods were imported from England, though Germans also reorganized their own agriculture and introduced new crops. In industry and transport, however, Germans were even more dependent on the technology already developed in England. Germany in the early 19th century had no modern steam-powered factories like those in England, no railroads, no sophisticated investment banking. Englishmen came over to Germany to install industrial equipment and teach German workers how to use it. Englishmen built railroads in Germany and remained to run them, because Germans did not yet have the technical capability to do so. Englishmen and English capital began the industrial manufacturing of wool in Germany and helped found the German steel industry. The Belgians and the French also provided some of the technological knowledge needed to get German industrialization going. However, by the end of the century, Germany had surpassed them all as an industrial power. The number of steam engines in the country rose from 400 in 1834 to triple that number by 1850. Coal production increased more than tenfold from 1815 to 1850. By mid-century, Germany had nearly twice as many miles of railroad as France. In the last decade of the 19th century, Germany overtook Great Britain in steel production. By 1913, on the eve of the First World War, German steel output was double that of the British. As Germans emigrated to other countries in Europe, the Western Hemisphere, and Australia, many went as bearers of the most advanced science and technology. Others went with artisan skills that were in the process of being superseded by modern industry in Germany, but which still had a contribution to make in other lands that had not yet reached that stage of economic development. Some Germans also brought with them a tradition of military prowess and skill, going back at least as far as the Roman Empire, when German generals held supreme command of Roman legions. Men of German ancestry were likewise to hold high command in the armies of Tsarist Russia, in South America, and in the United States, from the Revolutionary War of 1776 to the two world wars of the 20th century, in both of which the U.S. Army was commanded by generals of German ancestry, Pershing and Eisenhower, respectively. Germany in general, and Prussia in particular, have long been famed for their military traditions and exploits. In both world wars, Germany inflicted far more casualties on opposing armies than the German army itself sustained. In addition to a long list of famous military leaders over the centuries, Germany also produced the most famous theorist of the role of war, Karl von Clausewitz. Ironically, Germans around the world have also long been prominent among pacifist religious groups, as well as among military leaders. A high value placed on education was another characteristic that German emigrants took with them to other parts of the world. As early as the 17th century, Germany was noted as a place where educators were respected more so than in other parts of Europe. In the 19th century, Germany was one of the first European nations to have free and compulsory public education. Germany had more teachers per capita and a higher proportion of the national output was devoted to education than in many other European countries. This high priority of education was more than a policy of a government, it was a cultural value of a people. Germans in the Austrian Empire had literacy rates many times higher than Serbo-Croatians in the same empire, just as Germans had several times higher rates of literacy than Russians in the Russian Empire, and several times higher rates of literacy than Brazilians in Brazil. Kindergarten is a German word, and a German institution which took root in other lands, and, at the other end of the educational spectrum, the research-oriented German university likewise was imitated abroad, while great German intellectual and artistic figures such as Kant, Goethe, and Beethoven became part of the culture of Western civilization in general. Few German emigrants were at these Olympian levels, but their commitment to education and to the culture of their homeland found expression in the schoolhouses that sprang up wherever Germans settled, even in countries where the surrounding society had little or no interest in education and the bulk of the population was illiterate. In addition to education and a desire for education, highly specific scientific and technological skills migrated with the Germans to their new lands of settlement. The first pianos in colonial America were built by Germans, and Germans likewise pioneered in building pianos in Tsarist Russia, Australia, France, and England. A long German tradition of fine optical products, exemplified in such old optical firms as Zeiss, Schneider, and Voigtlander, lay behind the establishment of the leading optical firm in the United States, founded by two German emigrants named Bausch and Lohm. Germany's preeminence in the brewing of lager beer has been reflected in breweries established by German emigrants in other lands around the world. Germans were producing beer as far back as Roman times. In 1991, Germany produced more than twice as much beer as Russia, despite having a much smaller population. In fact, Germany's output of beer was exceeded only by that of the United States, where the leading breweries were founded by people of German ancestry. In short, German emigrants did not simply leave Germany. They took part of Germany with them, preserving its culture not only for themselves, but also making it part of the larger culture of the societies in which they settled. Russia. Germans became part of the population of Tsarist Russia in two very different ways. One, as a result of Russian conquests of Baltic states, which already had a substantial German population, and two, through the immigration of Germans to Russia. As early as the 16th century, there was a colony of Germans living in Moscow. By the early 18th century, the Germans living in Moscow numbered 20,000, and another 50,000 lived in St. Petersburg. But the first major immigration of Germans to Russia began later in the 18th century, during the reign of Catherine the Great, herself of German birth. By 1897, there were 1.8 million Germans living in the Russian Empire, three-fourths of them in rural areas. Though only 1% of the population of a vast empire, these Germans clustered in enclaves that remained German for generations, or even centuries. Three of the main concentrations were in the Baltic, on the Black Sea, and along the Volga River. Baltic Germans. Germans in the Baltic were a small proportion of all the Germans in Russia, and were less than one-tenth of the local population, even in the small Baltic states. There were about 100,000 Germans in the Baltic at the end of the 18th century, and about 130,000 at the end of the 19th century, 8% of the total population of the Baltic in the first period, and 6% in the second. However, the importance of the Baltic Germans to the local and national economies was out of all proportion to their numbers. Germans in the Baltic were a dominant socioeconomic class, rather than a disadvantaged minority. In 1900, for example, Germans owned 60% of the arable land in Estonia. In 1908, German landowners held more land throughout the Baltic than the indigenous Baltic peasants and the Russian domain and church lands combined. The Baltic port of Riga had one of the oldest entrepreneurial traditions in Russia. The fifth largest city in the Russian Empire, Riga was founded by Germans during the Middle Ages and remained culturally a German city for centuries thereafter. Its founding in 1201 AD was part of a long process of conquest of Latvia by German nobles, and it became part of the Hanseatic League of German commercial cities. Despite successive conquests by Poland, Sweden, and Russia over the centuries, Riga remained culturally German, though the city's population at the end of the 19th century was less than one-fourth German. Most of Riga's technology and capital came from Germany, even after it was incorporated into the Russian Empire in 1721. Merchants, artisans, and industrialists in Riga were overwhelmingly German. Riga German males had a 94% literacy rate as early as 1883, higher than that of Estonians, Latvians, Russians, or Jews in the same city, and far higher than that in the Russian Empire as a whole. From the time of Peter the Great, Germans were a significant proportion of the Russian Empire's total professional manpower. They filled many important scientific, scholarly, diplomatic, military, and other high-level positions. In the 1880s, about 40% of the Russian army's high command was German, as were 57% of the Russian foreign ministry and 62% of those in the highest ranks of the Ministry of Posts and Commerce. At one time, nearly all of the members of the St. Petersburg Academy of Sciences were German. In short, Germans were overrepresented in high-level positions, out of all proportion to their 1% of the total Russian Empire population. Moreover, these were mostly Baltic Germans. In the first half of the 19th century, Baltic Germans outnumbered all other Germans in Russia in high-level civil and military positions, even though they were a minority within the German minority in the Russian Empire. Germans in Russia were noted for traditional German orderliness, discipline, frugality, and calculation. Germans in high government positions were noted for their efficiency and incorruptibility, both characteristics in sharp contrast with Russian officials. Germans were also noted for their loyalty to Russia, even in the war against Germany in 1914. During the Napoleonic Wars, German generals were prominent in the leadership of the Russian army. It was one of these German generals, who was also partly Scottish, who devised the painful but ultimately successful strategy of a scorched earth policy in retreat, which broke the back of Napoleon's invasion of Russia. He later led the triumphant procession of the Russian army into Paris and was made a field marshal and a prince by the Tsar. Most of these German generals in the Russian army were from the Baltic region. In the Baltic nations of Latvia and Estonia, the upper classes were German and the lower classes Latvian and Estonian. Most urban Latvians had to be able to speak German, and those who rose up the economic scale became in the process Germanized in language and culture. The two groups also intermarried, making for an indistinct ethnic boundary between them, despite German cultural and economic dominance. The 1881 census showed that more than 10% of those who spoke Latvian as their native language nevertheless spoke German as their customary language. Upwardly mobile Estonians and Jews likewise tended to become German-speaking. Much of the educational activity of Riga was conducted in German, including education at Dorpat University, established by the Tsar in 1802. During the early decades of its existence, Dorpat University drew nearly half of its faculty from Germany. For all their cultural and economic dominance, however, the Baltic Germans of the 19th century were not a conscious nationality group, much less an exclusive one. People who were ethnically Latvian were socially accepted as they became culturally German. Baltic Germans were, at this point, cosmopolitan rather than nationalistic in outlook. But the rise of a newly emerging Latvian educated class, many educated at Dorpat University but refusing to become culturally German, signaled the beginning of nationality group politics in the Baltic. Germans in the Baltic long remained opposed to any arguments or policies based on race or nationality, just as the Germans in Bohemia did in response to rising Czech nationalism there. In both places, however, the indigenous nationalism not only grew, but eventually provoked a German counter-nationalism. In Russia, however, the situation was complicated by the rise of Russian nationalism in the latter part of the 19th century, expressing itself in a drive for the imposition of Russian culture and language throughout the empire. By the mid-1890s, every school in the Baltic, public or private, was forced to use Russian as the language of instruction. The police departments in the Baltic had to hire translators to translate their official reports from German into Russian, and this meant that German-staffed courts had to hire additional translators to translate the reports back from Russian to German so that the judges could understand them. As Russification proceeded, German school teachers, judges, university professors, and others began to lose their jobs, and many emigrated to Germany. By the late 1890s, German nationalism was developing in the Baltic, though historically Germans in the Baltic had never felt close to Germans in Germany. Russian chauvinism had bred German counter-chauvinism. The Baltic Germans no longer had the Russians to contend with after the Baltic states became independent as a result of World War I. However, World War II re-established Soviet, essentially Russian, control of the Baltic once more. But the Baltic Germans were at least spared the catastrophes which befell other Germans in Russia between the two world wars. Volga Germans. One of the earliest large-scale migrations from Germany was to a region of Russia near the lower Volga River. This migration was largely concentrated in a very few years, from 1763 to 1766, under a special dispensation from Catherine the Great. Immigrants were recruited in the war-devastated southwestern portion of Germany and were conveyed en masse, with Russian government subsidies, via the Baltic Sea to St. Petersburg, and then on a long journey down the Volga, settling eventually in a barren and desolate region near the frontier town of Saratov. The journey took many months on land and water, usually in crowded, uncomfortable quarters with poor food. What they found at the end of the journey was described by one of the early migrants as a wilderness, where, as far as the eye could see, was nothing but withered grass. By government design, the immigrants were settled as German enclaves, having both a separate legal status and a separate social existence from the Russian population in that part of the country. Catholics were also settled separately from Protestants. The purpose of the settlements was to provide more advanced demonstration models of efficient agriculture for the extremely backward Russian peasant masses. Despite a substantial outlay of Russian government funds, more than 5 million rubles, the early German colonists lived on the edge of desperation in the early years, and many perished. Corruption by Russian officials and civilians defrauded them of much of the money advanced by the government. Contrary to official assurances, there was simply no shelter available when they arrived, nor even the kind of trees needed for building log cabins. These German immigrants spent their first harsh winter in Russia in holes that they dug out of the ground, in hillsides, and along riverbanks, covered with such miscellaneous material as they could salvage from their belongings or gather in the vicinity. Thus they faced the sub-zero temperatures, snowstorms, and blizzards of the long Russian winter. Food had to be bought locally, at exorbitant prices, from Russians who took advantage of their plight. In the early years, the grain provided by the government for planting in the spring repeatedly arrived too late for effectively producing a crop. Bandits and marauding remnants of the descendants of the once great hordes of Genghis Khan robbed, terrorized, and devastated the region, even carrying off some of the Germans to be sold in the slave markets of Asia. Although the Volga German settlements had been promised local autonomy by Catherine the Great, Russian autocrats and bureaucrats constantly infringed and even openly violated these privileges. Village elders who complained about this policy were flogged. The fact that there were Baltic Germans among these government officials did not help, for Baltic Germans considered these South German peasants far beneath themselves. A few settlers who attempted the desperate gamble of trying to find a way back to Germany from deep inside Russia were overtaken by Cossacks and forced to return to their villages. Some, who paid a local guide to lead them out, were murdered for their money on the way. These early hardships and tragedies took their toll on the population. Of about 30,000 immigrants recruited, about 27,000 reached the Volga settlements, and a decade later, there were about 23,000 alive in these settlements. Over the first 2 years, the settlers built log cabins with logs floated down the Volga from northern Russia in warm weather. Altogether, there were more than 100 small colonies of German settlers. Here, an 18th-century Rhineland style of life existed, largely unchanged, and with little contact with both Russian and German developments for more than a century. When some of these Volga Germans re-immigrated to America in the latter part of the 19th century, there were children among them who had never seen a Russian, and even many of the adults never spoke the Russian language and had never seen a train. Intermarriage with the Russians was virtually out of the question, as was religious or other cultural assimilation. The Germans were sought by the Russian government and placed where they were precisely because they were more advanced than the ignorant Russian masses, and the Germans had no desire to retrogress to their level. Nevertheless, some cultural borrowings took place in both directions. The Russian materials with which the initial colonists' homes were built led to dwellings with characteristically Eastern European features, and heavy Russian clothing became necessary to cope with the harsh winters, while some Russian words became part of the local German dialects spoken by the various colonists. The wheat, barley, and oats planted by the Volga Germans were Russian varieties suited to the climate of the region. At the same time, Russian plows and wagons were improved upon by German adaptations, and the Russian sickle was replaced by the German scythe and cradle. Still, at the human level of day-to-day life, the German farmers lived in their own communities, apart from the Russian peasantry. Although only about half the settlers had been farmers in their homeland, virtually all had to become farmers on the Volga in order to survive. Nevertheless, those who had artisan skills passed them along to sons during the long Russian winters indoors. Others passed along the rudiments of literacy. Artisan skills proved valuable in the self-contained little communities where the Volga Germans made their own shoes, bricks, and farm implements. Once normal living conditions were established among Germans in the Volga region, few actually lived within sight of the river which gave them their name, their population size was recovered and then expanded rapidly. The population rose from its low of 23,000 in 1775, then more than doubled to 55,000 by 1811. The Volga Germans had many children. 10 to 12 in a family was common. This represented a birth rate more than double that of families in their German homeland. However, unwed motherhood remained rare throughout the history of these colonies. By 1861, there were 200,000 Germans living in the Volga colonies, and by the end of the 19th century, 400,000. Volga Germans constituted the largest group of Germans in Russia. Even though there were other largely agricultural colonies of Germans in such regions as the Black Sea, Bessarabia, and Volhynia. German settlers introduced new crops, such as potatoes and sugar beets, in the lower Volga region, developed improved strains of draft animals, built the first public schools in that area, and introduced a variety of new tools and techniques. The crops already native to the region were also grown more efficiently by the Germans than by the Russians. The Germans also built flour mills and manufactured cloth, both industries whose markets grew well beyond the narrow confines of the settler colonies to reach as far as St. Petersburg and even Finland. In addition, the Germans developed sawmills, forges, and tanneries, and manufactured wagons, furniture, spinning wheels, and other wooden implements and conveniences for themselves and then for Russian customers. By the 1840s, the Germans were so prosperous that envy and hostility toward them was aroused among the neighboring Russians. Yet with all these successes, the German farmers in Russia were not getting as high yields as contemporary German farmers in Germany, where progress had continued. Nevertheless, the Germans in Russia, on the Black Sea as well as the Volga, were a major factor in Russia's becoming an important exporter of wheat in the early 20th century. One of the German farm settlements became a show colony of the entire Russian Empire, visited by dignitaries, writers, and educators. The economic development of the German colonies was achieved despite political mismanagement and large-scale fraud and corruption by the Russian officials in charge, who sought vainly to force them to grow mulberry trees for silkworms and silk production, and attempted to discourage the rise of industry in these farming communities. Changing policies, officials, and political institutions kept the German colonists disturbed and apprehensive for generations. For many, the final blow came when one of the basic privileges bestowed upon them by Catherine the Great was revoked by her successors, exemption from military service. Military service was enormously feared, not only by those German religious sects opposed to any form of participation in war, but even by others with no such philosophical objections. Russian soldiers were kept on active military duty for many years, treated brutally, and paid a pittance. Moreover, soldiers of German ancestry were treated even worse than others, and especially when they could not speak Russian, as most of the Volga Germans could not. Military service requirements were also seen by the Germans as a major breach of faith by the Tsarist government and the harbinger of the destruction of whatever remaining guarantees they had. Moreover, a rising tide of pan-Slavism and Russification policies threatened to destroy the whole way of life they had built up with their own schools, churches, and other community institutions. In the early 1890s, a major new migration began. By now practicing an agriculture adapted to the steppes of Russia, they sought out similar land in the Great Plains of the United States and Western Canada, and in the Argentine Pampas. These three regions in the Western Hemisphere, like the Volga Steppes, have been among the most productive grain-producing regions of the world. Black Sea Germans. The German colonies in the region of the Black Sea were founded somewhat later in the 18th century than those on the Volga, and had a less hostile natural and political environment to contend with. Among the many separate colonies were those of the Mennonites, who were experienced farmers and prospered earlier than other Black Sea Germans, who had to adapt to agriculture. Observers noted the cleanliness and orderliness of the Mennonite villages. Their farming practices were so much more advanced than those of other farmers that the Tsarist government held them up as models and even forcibly imposed some of their farming methods on others. The rapidly growing population of Black Sea Germans reached about 150,000 by 1860. Despite dust storms, locusts, and other causes of recurring and devastating crop failures, the Black Sea German colonies became more prosperous over the years. By building grain storage facilities, the German colonies escaped the famines which sporadically afflicted others in Russia. From the decade of the 1830s onward, the Black Sea Germans began to sell commercially important amounts of grain. Their prosperity was indicated by the expansion of their land holdings. Over a period of three decades, beginning in 1860, vast areas of land passed from the hands of the Russian nobility to the Black Sea German farmers, eventually totaling more than 11 million acres. By 1912, an estimated 41% of the arable land in the Crimean Peninsula was owned by Germans. In four provinces of southern Russia, the land owned by the Germans in 1914 was more than six times what they had been allocated originally by the Tsars. For the Black Sea Germans, as for their compatriots on the Volga, the anti-German propaganda of pan-Slav chauvinism, the Russification campaigns, and especially the imposition of military service, were heavy blows that raised serious questions about their whole future in Russia. Moreover, despite the politicized resentment aroused against the Germans in Russia, other nations were anxious to have them. Brazil and Argentina sent agents to Russia to recruit them as immigrants, making promises and offering help in resettling. Canada and the United States, at about the same time, were making land available to immigrants in general. About 18,000 Mennonites left Russia for the United States and Canada in the 1870s, but the mass exodus of Germans in general from the Black Sea region took place later, after the assassination of Tsar Alexander II in 1881 brought to power a new Tsar, far more hostile to foreigners in Russia. As the local autonomy of the German colonies was replaced by their direct rule by local Russian-appointed officials, new harassments ensued. A massive emigration of Black Sea Germans began to both North and South America. By the early 20th century, the largest concentrations of Black Sea Germans in the Western Hemisphere were in the Dakotas. Most of the Germans who settled in Western Canada during this era came from Russia, not Germany. Russian policy. Like other prospering minorities in other countries, the Germans in Russia faced growing hostility. Envy was a major factor, not only as regards the Volga, Black Sea, and other German farm communities, but perhaps still more so for Baltic Germans, who had long been overrepresented at high levels in Moscow and St. Petersburg. Many Russians saw their careers blocked by the competition of the Germans. Pan-Slavism and intolerance of foreigners flourished in the Russian upper classes, who had the greatest stake in getting rid of competitors for lucrative and prestigious positions. Russian intellectuals were prominent in the anti-German campaigns. Among the Russian masses, however, such idiomatic expressions as punctual as a German or as honest as a German suggest an appreciation of the qualities these people exhibited. Germans and the Russians continued to live separate lives, and intermarriage remained very rare. One index of their cultural differences was education. At the end of the 19th century, more than three-quarters of all Russians were still illiterate, while literacy was pervasive among the Germans, even the German farmers, who had set up their own schools in their own communities. German newspapers and periodicals were a consequence and a reflection of this literacy. The Odessa Zeitung was just one of the newspapers which flourished among the Black Sea Germans, as the Saratov Deutsche Zeitung did among the Volga Germans, while the St. Petersburg Zeitung had been in existence since 1727. World War I, pitting Russia against Germany, and the staggering military losses suffered by the Russians, raised anti-German feeling to new heights. Germans in Russia were accused of betraying the country to the Kaiser, though no specific charge of treason was brought against any of the 2.4 million Germans in the country. About 200,000 Germans were forced to evacuate one of the Ukrainian provinces on short notice and were shipped off to the Volga, Central Asia, and Siberia. Thousands perished in the packed, suffocating boxcars, where there was little food and no medical care. In 1915, Moscow mobs rampaged through a German suburb, destroying millions of rubles worth of property, as well as injuring and killing innocent people. Hundreds of German businesses and homes were burned and looted. In 1917, the Tsar issued an order banishing the Volga Germans, but the May Revolution took place before this order could be carried out. After the Kerensky government was replaced by the communists in the fall of 1917, the Volga German Workers' Commune was proclaimed, with its purpose being to combat the big landowners and counter-revolutionaries in the German colonies. Though there were only 300 communists among 400,000 Volga Germans, they were a majority in terms of brute force and political power. The material prosperity built up by generations of Volga Germans was depicted politically as their robbery of the have-nots, who were entitled to take it back. By the standards of the Russian peasant, even the average German farmer was considered wealthy. Marauding bands pillaged, tortured, raped, and devastated the Volga German community. The number of cattle in those communities dropped from more than 700,000 to fewer than 300,000 in just 1 year. Agricultural output in the region declined for several years. The Volga Germans experienced their first great famine. An estimated 166,000 people died of starvation in the Volga after their food and seed grains were repeatedly requisitioned and looted. Meanwhile, the Soviet government sold 282,000 metric tons of grain abroad to get foreign exchange. Like much of the Soviet Union, the Volga region recovered somewhat under Lenin's new economic policy in the early 1920s, which allowed some functioning of the marketplace and some private property. But the end of the new economic policy and the beginning of collectivized agriculture in 1927 marked the beginning of a new tragedy for the Volga Germans. Many of these German family farmers, even of very modest means, were considered kulaks, or rich peasants, agricultural capitalists, or exploiters, in the political rhetoric of the day. Many were deported, directly liquidated, or died of malnutrition, cold, abuse, or overwork in the slave labor camps. Disrupting the most productive segment of Soviet agriculture, in turn, had enormous impact on output, resulting in another famine. Again, the Soviet government made massive exports of grain, while literally millions starved to death. Not all hostility to the Germans in Russia by the communists was racial or ethnic. Much of it was ideological. Germans had a history of voting against communists and socialists under both the Tsarist and Kerensky governments, and in the civil war that followed the Bolshevik Revolution, Germans fought primarily on the side of the whites against the Reds. Germans were also overwhelmingly a rural peasantry, a group which bore the brunt of Stalin's draconian collectivization policy in the 1930s. Urban Germans did not suffer nearly as much. Throughout this era, as in centuries past, The Germans in Russia maintained their cultural traditions and their separate social cohesiveness. In the mid-1920s, 85% of German men in Russia married German women, and 95% of all Germans in Russia spoke the German language. This reflected the continued rural, isolated existence of most Germans in the Soviet Union. Among Germans living in cities, intermarriage with Russian or Ukrainian women was not as rare as in the countryside. The end of the Volga Germans as a cohesive people in Russia came in 1941. After the Nazis invaded the USSR in June of that year, Stalin ordered about 380,000 Volga Germans deported behind the Ural Mountains. Families were separated, the fathers and sons together, and the others in separate trains. Once again, the cold, the packed conditions in the railroad cars, and the lack of food took their toll among the passengers. The corpses of those who died were strewn along the railroad tracks. Even those who survived the deportation and years in the forced labor camps were not allowed back after the war. Decades later, in the 1980s, the remnants of the Volga Germans in the Soviet Union were located principally in Central Asia, with many families not yet reunited, much less a cohesive community reconstituted. Some individuals even denied that they were Volga Germans, for fear of what might someday happen again. By this time, identifiable Volga Germans existed mainly in the United States and Argentina. As late as 1975, about one-fifth of the population of the Argentine province of Entre Rios were Volga Germans. Across the river from Entre Rios, in Uruguay, there was another concentration of Germans from Russia. As the Soviet Union became the Commonwealth of Independent States in the 1990s, the number of Volga Germans remaining in the territory of the former USSR was approximately 2 million. They were now widely scattered, so assimilated that most no longer spoke German and many married outside the group. Heavy emigration to Germany also reduced their numbers. The experience of the Black Sea Germans in post-revolutionary Russia was very much the same as that of those hundreds of miles away on the Volga. After the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917, roving bands of Russian peasants seized food, clothing, horses, and cattle from the German communities in the name of sharing. The occupation of the Crimea by invading armies from Germany provided a brief respite in 1918, but the invaders' return to Germany after the end of World War I brought a return of Russian bands of robbers who flourished in the anarchy of the Civil War era. They spread a new reign of terror in the German communities. Houses were burned, people tortured, women raped, and men shot. When the Red Army restored order, it was a very different order from what had existed before. Confiscations were now systematic rather than random. The dispossession of the most efficient farmers, politically branded as capitalists, despite the modest size of their farms, reduced agricultural output. Black Sea Germans now experienced their first famine, though famines were an old story to Russians. Another respite during Lenin's new economic policy allowed the Black Sea Germans to recover somewhat, but their unusual productivity, by Russian standards, only made them political targets again when Stalin's collectivization drive and liquidation of kulaks began. The invasion of the Soviet Union by Nazi armies in 1941 was followed by mass deportations of Black Sea Germans to the east by the Soviet government, even before the same fate befell the Volga Germans. Those Black Sea Germans who were still in areas overrun by the Nazi invaders welcomed them as liberators after the ordeals they had experienced under the communists, and later, more than 250,000 Germans in Russia followed the retreating Nazi army back to Germany in 1943-44, many dying along the way in the brutal conditions of war and weather. After the war was over, tens of thousands were forcibly returned to Russia by the occupying Red Army, but tens of thousands of others hid under false identities. Some who were discovered committed suicide rather than go back. The wartime experiences of Germans throughout the Soviet Union had enduring consequences. The autonomous German Republic of the Volga, established in 1922, was abolished in 1941 and never reconstituted during the era of the Soviet Union, nor the Germans deported to Central Asia and Siberia allowed to return to that region. when Germans as a group were more or less politically rehabilitated after Stalin's death, and German language newspapers were permitted once again, these papers carried special columns headed Search for Missing Relatives. Many children had lost all contact with their parents during the wartime deportations, had no way of knowing whether they were dead or alive, and were themselves mistreated in orphanages or foster homes by Russians who regarded them as little traitors. The neglect of this generation's education can be seen in later official Soviet data, showing that 12% of Soviet Germans living in the Novosibirsk region of Siberia in 1967 had no education at all, and another 25% only 1 to 3 years of schooling. This, among a people historically more educated than the Russians, and with a record of strong interest in education in countries around the world. In the Central Asian Republic of Kyrgyzstan, where 70,000 or more Germans lived, there were fewer than 150 German students in institutions of higher education in academic year 1960-61, and from 1955 to 1966, none at all among scientific researchers with doctoral degrees. About half of all Germans in the Soviet Union now lived in Kazakhstan, and here, too, they remain statistically underrepresented among students in higher education. With the post-Stalin relaxation of anti-German policies, however, the numbers of German students in Soviet institutions of higher education rose sharply. The number of German students in Kazakhstan more than tripled between 1960 and 1971. In Kyrgyzstan, they increased more than sixfold. Given their educational deficiencies and the fact that only about half of them were urbanized even in the 1980s, the post-war Germans have tended to have lower incomes and occupations than other Soviet citizens. The long years that many spent in forced labor camps under harsh conditions obviously did not benefit either their skills or their health. As of 1970, there were more than 1.8 million people of German ancestry in the Soviet Union, about two-thirds of whom spoke German as their mother tongue. This was about the same as the number of Germans in the Russian Empire in 1897, and considerably less than the 2.4 million Germans in Russia in 1916. This population decline in a predominantly rural population, historically noted for its high fertility, was one index of the devastations suffered by Germans in Tsarist Russia and in the Soviet Union. However, it may also reflect a reluctance of some people to identify themselves as German to the census taker, or the census taker's own bias toward having people identify themselves in assimilated terms, in keeping with official Soviet ideology. German culture was not completely obliterated in the Soviet Union, and in fact had a minor revival in the post-Stalin era. However, it had clearly declined from past generations. Even after the teaching of the German language in school was once more permitted in 1956 in Siberia and Kazakhstan, most Germans did not avail themselves of the opportunity in the years that followed, perhaps not wishing to call attention to themselves as German after all that they had been through. The German newspapers, which had disappeared completely during the war, were replaced in the post-Stalin era by a number of German language papers set up by the Soviet government. The largest of these, Neues Leben, was first published in Moscow in 1957 and was still run by Russians in the 1980s. The first German language radio broadcasts of the post-war era also began in 1957, for a few hours daily on Radio Alma-Ata, located in Kazakhstan. As of 1970, more than 90% of the Germans in the Soviet Union lived in Asia. In the post-war era, Germans have been second only to Jews in the numbers emigrating from the Soviet Union. In both cases, such emigration was made possible only because of outside influences. In the case of the Germans, a desire to establish better relations with West Germany led the Soviet government to accede to requests from West German Chancellor Konrad Adenauer to permit some emigration. Likewise, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, Russian President Boris Yeltsin suggested, during an official visit to a united Germany, the revival of an autonomous Volga German Republic. An agreement between Russia and Germany in 1992 provided for the latter to invest in the Volga region in order to create better conditions there to forestall a mass movement of people returning to a Germany they never knew, many of them no longer speaking German. In peace as in war, Soviet Germans were pawns of forces beyond their control. Of the 2.8 million ethnic Germans who returned to Germany in the post-war world through 1992, just over half, 1.5 million, came from the Eastern European countries of the former Soviet bloc after 1987. As an ironic footnote, Lenin's maternal grandmother was a Volga German. The Western Hemisphere. Germans came to the Western Hemisphere both as immigrants and as re-immigrants, the latter largely from Tsarist Russia and later the Soviet Union. There were also large numbers of people of German ancestry who came from Switzerland, Austria, and other parts of Europe where substantial numbers of Germans lived outside the Reich. A few also came from the German colonial empire in Africa. Nor were these Germans from outside Germany a minor part of the German immigration from Europe. Prior to World War I, only about 10% of the Germans who immigrated to Canada came from Germany. While most German immigrants to the United States came from Germany, there were also, by 1920, about 300,000 descendants of Germans from Russia living in the United States. More than two-thirds were either Volga Germans or Black Sea Germans, about evenly divided. As of 1928, there were also an estimated 100,000 Volga Germans living in Argentina. Half a century later, there were still distinctive communities of Volga Germans in Argentina, with their own Asociación Argentina de los Alemanes del Volga. A visitor to a rural village in Argentina in 1967 described this scene. "I entered the church and heard something I did not remotely expect in this distant place. Traditional German hymns of Holy Week, sung in typical Volga German style in which each voice remains distinct. I looked around. Men, women, and children were in their Sunday dress. Some of the women wore scarves. Beneath them were faces like those of the country people in Germany. In front of the nave, the minister was preaching in common German to the parishioners. It was difficult to believe that I was in Latin America, that the ancestors of these people had left Germany for Russia 200 years ago." While this was an extreme example of the persistence of German culture, through centuries of living in very different surrounding societies, nevertheless, it was indicative of a pattern that existed more widely in the Western Hemisphere and elsewhere. With Germans, as with other immigrants, the nature of the surrounding society affected the degree to which they wished to assimilate. Though Germans were often especially slow to adopt the language or the outward cultural patterns of the countries in which they settled. Even after they did so, they still remained distinctive in the particular skills they brought and in their patterns of hard work, thrift, and law-abiding behavior. Among the German immigrants to the Western Hemisphere were members of the Mennonite religious sect, whose immigrations and re-immigrations were part of a worldwide odyssey in search of security for their special way of life. Among the Mennonites who settled in Canada and the United States, some later immigrated again in groups to Mexico and then still later to Honduras. Others re-immigrated to Paraguay. One of the descendants of the Germans in Paraguay became president of the country. These moves by Mennonites were usually made in response to perceived threats to their way of life, notably government attempts to force their children to attend state schools or to force their young men into the military, contrary to their religious tenets. German immigrants to the Western Hemisphere, like German immigrants to other parts of the world, tended first to be family farmers and later to include more and more industrial workers and people from commerce, industry, science, and scholarship. Even in the earliest centuries of settlement in the Western Hemisphere, however, German technological know-how made its imprint. Germans were noted for their achievements in mining as early as the 16th century, when Spain, Norway, and Mexico all imported Germans to build and operate silver mines, and England brought in Germans to open up copper mines. Even earlier, Germans were noted as mapmakers, and it was a German mapmaker who gave the name America to the new world of the Western Hemisphere. Germans also manufactured the first armor and swords in Mexico, and produced the first printing press in the Western Hemisphere, as well as the first paper mill in North America. While the largest number of German immigrants went to the United States, some of their most dramatic impacts on the economic development of their new homelands were in South America. As of 1873, there were more than 40 German import-export businesses in Buenos Aires, and a number of German breweries there drove English beer from the local market. By the time of the First World War, German academics were dominant in Argentina's Institute of Physics, Astronomical Laboratory, Natural History Museum, National Bureau of Mines and Geology, and in its Institute of Military Geography. In Brazil, the Germans' impact on the industrialization of the country was especially remarkable because the approximately 224,000 Germans who immigrated to Brazil between 1872 and 1972 were outnumbered by Japanese immigrants, 248,000, by Spanish immigrants, 716,000, by Italian immigrants, 1.6 million, and by Portuguese immigrants, 1.7 million. Yet none of the others had the same impact on the development of Brazilian industry as the Germans did. It was not in industry or commerce alone that the Germans transformed the lands to which they migrated. Whole virgin regions of Chile, Paraguay, Brazil, and Argentina were opened up to farming by Germans, often under arduous pioneering conditions. German immigrants also made major contributions to the development of public education in Chile. However, the earliest and largest migrations of Germans were to the United States, where more Germans immigrated in 1 year than the 224,000 who immigrated to Brazil in a century. At one time, the United States was third in the world in the number of people who spoke German, exceeded in this respect only by Germany and Austria. The United States. The substantial number of German immigrants who settled in colonial America were but the beginning of a growing tide of immigration of Germans, not only from Germany itself, but also from Austria, Switzerland, Russia, and elsewhere. After the emergence of the United States as an independent nation, Germans became the largest element in the massive immigrations of the 19th and early 20th centuries. Between 1820 and 1970, approximately 7 million Germans immigrated to the United States, constituting 15% of all immigrants during that period. Between 1850 and 1900, Germans were never less than one-fourth of all immigrants to the U.S. During the colonial era, half or more of the German immigrants came as redemptioners, people whose passage across the ocean was paid by others in exchange for a certain number of years of indentured labor thereafter. While individual Germans settled in colonial America from the earliest days of the colonies, and scattered German settlements were attempted as well, the first permanent German settlement in the American colonies was Germantown, Pennsylvania, founded in 1683 near Philadelphia, which ultimately absorbed it in 1707. Germantown was the first of many culturally German enclaves that would be established in the Western Hemisphere, as well as in Russia and Australia. After a poverty-stricken beginning, Germantown became an early focal point of German culture in America, distributing both German language literature and new German immigrants to Western Pennsylvania. The community became known for its hard-working people, its woven goods, the first paper mill in the colonies, its low crime rate, and the reluctance of its people to hold political office. It was here also that the first protest meeting against slavery in America was held in 1688. German farming communities in Pennsylvania became part of a whole string of German agricultural settlements scattered from upstate New York down through New Jersey and from Pennsylvania southward, forming an almost unbroken chain of German-speaking communities, reaching down through the Cumberland Gap into the Shenandoah Valley, the Carolina-Piedmont region, and on into Georgia. Along these hundreds of miles, Germans tended to cluster together, though other elements, especially the Scotch-Irish, were also present in the region. This was frontier country at the time, and Germans settled in these parts because land was cheap enough for them to afford it. German pioneers cleared forests and built their own farmhouses, schoolhouses, and churches. They were widely known for their industriousness, thrift, neatness, punctuality, and reliability in meeting their financial obligations, as well as for retaining their own German language and customs. Their farms were more productive, and their animals better cared for than those of most other groups. When they took over farms that others had worked, it was said that they often grew rich on farms on which their predecessors had nearly starved. Early German pioneers often had contacts with the aboriginal American Indians, with whom they generally had better relations than did most other European settlers. This pattern of generally good relations between the Germans and the Indians was to continue as the American frontier moved west, though the Germans, like other settlers, were sometimes attacked by the natives and fought fiercely against them. Although German farmers established an enviable reputation, not all German immigrants were farmers. Urban Germans were often skilled artisans and craftsmen, who also soon became well known for the high quality of their work. Steubenglass, printing, ironworks, the Conestoga wagon, and the Kentucky rifle, actually originating in Pennsylvania, were among their products. Beer was also brewed in many German settlements, and German names such as Budweiser and Coors remained prominent among the leading American beer companies. German military skills and traditions began playing a major role in American history with the War for Independence. These military skills came not only from such German Americans as John Peter Muhlenberg, but also from a number of top military officers who arrived from Germany for the express purpose of helping to lead the American armies. Chief among these was General Friedrich Wilhelm von Steuben, who has been credited with turning the motley military forces of the American colonies into a real army. German-American military men of later times included those with anglicized names, such as General George Custer, Custer among his ancestors, the Indian fighter, and General John J. Pershing, Fushing, commander of the American armies in World War I. German Americans in the military high command in World War II included General Dwight D. Eisenhower, who led the armies that invaded Normandy, Admiral Chester Nimitz, who commanded the Pacific Fleet, and General Karl Spatz, whose bombers reduced much of Germany to rubble. General Norman Schwarzkopf, commander of the American and Allied forces in the Persian Gulf War of 1991, represented yet another chapter in this long tradition. After the American Revolutionary War, German farmers continued to settle on or near the frontier, but that frontier was now much farther west, in Wisconsin, Missouri, and Texas, for example. Where 18th century Germans had come from the southwestern part of Germany, 19th century immigrants came from more diversified origins, and especially from the northwestern part of the country. Many German immigrants gained access to the upper Midwest and the Plain States overland from the East Coast ports, but many others landed at New Orleans and came up the Mississippi River. St. Louis, which was the terminus of steamboat lines from New Orleans, received such a concentration of Germans that by 1845 the city had two German-language daily newspapers. With the development of railroads and canals in the northern states, the immigrant traffic through the port of New Orleans tended to be limited to those headed for Texas or remaining in New Orleans itself. By 1880, there were more than 17,000 Germans in Louisiana, nearly 14,000 of them living in New Orleans. They were prominent in artisan crafts and became the sole producers of lager beer in that city. As early as 1850, the principal region in which German immigrants were concentrated was the upper Midwest, especially Wisconsin, and this remained true as late as 1920. The next largest concentration was in the Middle Atlantic states, in which Germans had first settled in the 18th century. By 1960, the Mid-Atlantic states were again the primary destinations of German immigrants. These historic immigrant settlement patterns continued to be reflected in ethnic distribution patterns generations later. In the late 20th century, people of German ancestry constituted 56% of the population of Wisconsin and half or more of the population of four other Midwestern and Great Plains states. During the era of mass immigration, people from particular small areas of Germany often settled together in very specific places in the United States. For example, immigrants from the county of Tecklenburg in the province of Westphalia settled in two adjoining counties in Missouri. Villages were practically transplanted from Germany to rural Missouri, according to one study. Frankfort, Kentucky was founded by Germans from Frankfort, Germany, and Grand Island, Nebraska by Schleswig-Holsteiners. Lomira, Wisconsin was settled almost exclusively by Prussians from Brandenburg, while the nearby towns of Hermann and Teresa were settled by Pomeranians. Farther out on the northern plains, Germans re-immigrating from Russia also settled in clusters related to their places of origin. Some of these communities were named for places in Russia, Odessa in North and South Dakota and in Washington State, and Moscow in both Dakotas, or were named for places in Germany, Leipzig, Berlin, and Strasbourg, North Dakota, and Krupp, South Dakota, not to mention Holstein and Kiel in Oklahoma. In the 19th century, there was already an American newspaper called the Odessa Zeitung. Germans from Russia long remained differentiated from other Americans, from Germans from Germany, and among themselves. For example, the Black Sea Germans led a separate existence in the United States, with social patterns quite distinctive from those of Volga Germans. At one time, 95% of the Black Sea Germans were wheat farmers, while only about half the Volga Germans remained in agriculture, and these produced sugar beets. As late as the 1930s, it was estimated that more than half the sugar beet farms in Colorado, Nebraska, Montana, and Wyoming were in the hands of Volga Germans. Germans from Russia were also differentiated by religion. It was estimated that more than four-fifths of all Catholic Black Sea Germans in the United States lived in either North or South Dakota. Even when some of the later generations of Black Sea Germans and Volga Germans resettled in California, they settled separately, the former around Lodi and the latter around Fresno. Just as their forebears had had to adapt their crops to Russian conditions, so the Russian-German immigrants had to adapt once more to American farming conditions and living conditions. The kinds of wheat, tobacco, and watermelons they had grown in Russia had to be replaced by American varieties. Moreover, American homestead laws promoted individual settlement, scattered among many other American and other immigrant farmers, rather than the recreation of whole German colonies, as in Russia. However, where local conditions permitted, such colonies were recreated, as in Ellis County, Kansas, where large tracts of land were bought from the Kansas Pacific Railroad. Moreover, within these German colonies, there were Catholic villages and Protestant villages, with intermarriage between Catholics and Protestants remaining rare on into the 1920s. Even in an urban setting, Volga German factory workers clustered together in Chicago as late as 1930. German immigrants' achievement as farmers in the United States remained outstanding in the 19th and 20th centuries. In eastern Texas, German farmers were by 1880 producing a larger volume of output per farm, and on smaller farms, than other Texans. In Nebraska, Colorado, Montana, and Wyoming, Germans who had re-immigrated from Russia established good reputations as farmers and had excellent credit ratings at banks. Germans, both from Germany and from Russia, eventually achieved prosperity in Oklahoma after harrowing years of pioneering in a virgin territory. The 19th century saw a general shift of the growing German population from the eastern seaboard states to the Midwest, particularly to the upper Mississippi and Ohio valleys. By the middle of the 19th century, this region contained more than half of all German-born people in the United States. The Midwest was not only the destination of 19th century German immigrants, but also a destination of East Coast German Americans or their descendants. Not all these Germans were farmers, however. Cities such as Cincinnati, St. Louis, and above all Milwaukee became centers of urban German populations in the 19th century. Only 5% of Cincinnati's population was German in 1830, but by 1860, 30% of the city's inhabitants were German. Milwaukee's Germans were 35% of the population. A number of smaller communities were even more completely German, not only in population, but in language as well. Herman, Missouri, for example, had its street signs in German. In rural areas, the concentration of German people and the dominance of the German language were even greater. Whether rural or urban, Germans in the 19th century tended to retain their culture, as their predecessors had done in earlier centuries. The German language could be heard spoken on the streets of Cincinnati or St. Louis, and German language newspapers appeared daily in 15 American cities. These daily newspapers ranged across the country, from Die New Yorker Staatszeitung to the Cincinnati Volksblatt, the Chicago Abendpost, the Louisville Anzeiger, and the Deutsche Zeitung in New Orleans. Approximately four-fifths of the entire foreign language press in the United States was German. There were also innumerable German associations, whether gymnastic, musical, social, or literary. These existed not only in urban areas, but even in such agricultural regions as the hill country of Texas. All in all, it was possible for many German Americans to live for generations in German enclaves, whether rural or urban, never having to venture into the English-speaking world for education, church, recreation, or marriage partners. Not all did so, by any means, for American-born generations were attracted toward the cultural mainstream of the United States, even as the massive inflow of new German immigrants kept alive the culture of Germany. However, even the cultural mainstream of America began to take on features once peculiar to Germans. These included not only such old country traditions as lager beer, coleslaw, delicatessen, and the Christmas tree, but also such German improvisations on American soil as oatmeal and those all-American foods deriving their names from German cities, frankfurters and hamburgers. Above all, perhaps, Germans profoundly influenced American recreational patterns. The innumerable innocent but secular and zestful recreations of the Germans, from songfests to bowling to parades, target shooting and swimming, were at first viewed by other Americans with suspicion and reproach, especially when they took place on Sunday, in contravention of more puritanical norms in the larger community. But ultimately, such peaceful and enjoyable activities, often engaged in by family groups, began to become part of the American way of life. Germans played a major role in making music a part of American life, not only by breaking down puritanical prejudices against singing, but also by promoting all kinds of music, from folk music and marching bands to the great symphony orchestras. Many of the leading American classical music conductors of the 19th century were of German ancestry, as were the overwhelming majority of the members of the New York Philharmonic Orchestra in the last half of the 19th century. Increasingly, as German immigration to the United States rose during the 19th century, the predominance of farmers among the immigrants declined. The rising urban component brought with them many artisan and industrial skills or entrepreneurial talents. Most Germans who worked in mid-19th century New York, Boston, Detroit, St. Louis, or Milwaukee were either skilled manual workers or were in non-manual occupations, while the Irish, for example, were in mostly unskilled or semi-skilled occupations in the same cities at the same time. Similarly, in San Francisco in 1870, 38% of the Irish immigrants were unskilled, compared to only 7% of the Germans. Germans also tended to be well represented in business and the professions. In the middle of the 19th century, one-third of all the physicians in New York State were German. In Milwaukee, at about the same time, nearly half of all the shopkeepers were German. The success and prominence of Germans in agriculture, industry, commerce, and the professions was not repeated in politics, however. In the 19th century, as in the 18th century, Germans tended to be underrepresented among those pursuing political careers, and the German electorate tended to be apathetic as well. Moreover, those Americans of German ancestry who did achieve distinction in politics, notably the Muhlenbergs in the 18th century, Carl Schurz and John Peter Altgeld in the 19th, and Herbert Hoover and Dwight D. Eisenhower in the 20th century, did so as spokesmen for the general population on broad national issues, not as ethnic representatives of German-American community special interests. The general political leanings of German Americans in the 18th and 19th centuries tended to be more liberal or progressive than those of their contemporaries. However, there was no monolithic German position on the issues of the day. Although Germans tended to be anti-slavery throughout the history of that institution, there were many cross-currents, though no prominent German-American leaders were pro-slavery. Moreover, when a vote was taken in antebellum North Carolina to take away many legal rights of free Negroes, the German areas voted to let them keep those rights, while the state as a whole voted to abrogate their rights. When the Civil War came, the large German population in Missouri was credited with keeping that state in the Union, despite many Confederate sympathizers. On other issues of personal freedom, such as laws against drinking or laws restricting Sunday activities, the Germans voted for the freedom of the individual. Within their own community enclaves, Germans welcomed German Jews as members of such organizations as the Turnverein, singing groups, and other cultural organizations. German immigration to the United States peaked in the decade of the 1880s, when more than 1.4 million arrived on American shores. By the first decade of the 20th century, however, German immigration had fallen to less than one-fourth of that. The pioneering struggles of the 18th and 19th centuries gave way to very different kinds of adversity in the 20th century. Economically, the rise of mass production industry devalued and superseded many of the artisan skills among German workers, including many crafts associated with horse and buggy transportation, shoemaking, and furniture production. The rise of the meatpacking industry reduced the role of the German butcher shops, as the rise of mass marketing in general through department stores and supermarkets likewise eclipsed the German specialty shopkeepers. The declining importance of family farms and the rise of mechanized mass production agriculture also could not help adversely affect the vast number of German family farmers scattered across many states. International political developments likewise had their impact on German Americans. The outbreak of the First World War in Europe in 1914 brought much condemnation of Germany in the United States. German Americans were adversely affected, in part because of a generalized hostility to Germans and German culture, and perhaps more so because German American spokesmen tended to try to justify the actions of their ancestral homeland, which was waging a war of aggression in Europe. When the United States ultimately joined the war against Germany, feelings ran higher still among Americans in general, though German Americans loyally served in the U.S. military forces, and America's leading fighter pilot was of German ancestry, Eddie Rickenbacker. Nevertheless, the German language was banished from many American high school curricula, as German music was banished from concert halls. Some marriage ceremonies no longer used wedding marches by Mendelssohn or Wagner. German books were removed from library shelves, and German-American newspapers were boycotted by advertisers and readers. While this anti-German hysteria did not reach the levels it reached in some other countries, such as Russia, Brazil, or Australia, it was real enough and painful enough to German Americans. These attacks also hastened the demise of many German American associations. Some of these organizations simply dropped any reference to Germany in their titles, as the Germania Life Insurance Company of New York changed its name to the Guardian Life Insurance Company, for example. While the anti-German hostility subsided quickly after the war, it nevertheless contributed to the already existing trend of declining cultural and social cohesion among Germans in the United States. In the early 20th century, Germans in many parts of the United States still married mostly other Germans, even in an urban center like New York City, where 90% of the population was non-German. Intermarriage increased with the passing decades, however. Other indices of assimilation included the decline of the large German language press. German language daily and weekly publications, numbering more than 700 in 1890, declined to barely 200 in 1920, and continued to decline to 81 in 1940 and to 33 by 1960. German cultural organizations likewise declined sharply over the years, as German Americans became more assimilated and many disappeared into the larger society. The rise of Hitler and the Nazis in Germany during the 1930s led to efforts to recruit German Americans to the cause, largely without success. A Nazi front organization, the German American Bund, was established in 1936 with financial support from Germany and made headlines with spectacular rallies and fiery rhetoric, but it made little headway with most German Americans. The organization disbanded when the United States entered the Second World War in 1941. In the larger society, there was no such hostility to German Americans during World War II as there had been in World War I, and few found it noteworthy, much less controversial, that the American Army in Europe, the U.S. Pacific Fleet, and the American Air Force in Europe were all commanded by men of German ancestry. Over the years, Germans have made major contributions to many aspects of American society. In addition to the contributions of broad masses of German people in agriculture and industry, and of German food, customs, and attitudes toward recreation, numerous individuals of German ancestry made historic contributions in various fields. Engineering history was made when John A. Roebling designed and built the Brooklyn Bridge, the first of many long-span suspension bridges which are now taken for granted, though the Brooklyn Bridge was a pioneering marvel in its day, made possible by the steel cables which Roebling also designed and produced. The genius of German-born engineer Charles Steinmetz provided the basis on which the General Electric Corporation was built. Firms established by individuals of German ancestry have been among the leaders in many American industries, including optics, Bausch & Lomb, wood products, Weyerhaeuser, automobiles, Chrysler, pianos, Steinway, Schnabel, organs, Wurlitzer, candy, Hershey, prepared food, Heinz, language instruction, Berlitz, and innumerable beer companies, including Anheuser-Busch, Miller, Coors, Pabst, Schlitz, and Blotz. Germans are no longer a distinctive group in America because they have become so much a part of American society, and that society has absorbed so many German cultural features, from kindergartens to Christmas trees to coleslaw. Yet it may be indicative of how long German cultural ties endured that the German language was spoken in childhood by such disparate 20th century American figures as famed writer H.L. Mencken, baseball stars Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig, and by the Nobel Prize-winning economist George Steigler. Brazil. Substantial German immigration to Brazil, as to South America in general, began early in the 19th century and included over the years not only immigrants from what is now Germany, but also sizable numbers of Germans from Russia, Switzerland, and Austria. Most settled in the southern part of Brazil, concentrated in the state of Rio Grande do Sul, where the first enduring German agricultural colony was established in 1824, though earlier unsuccessful attempts to establish German colonies in Brazil go back to the late 18th century. Settlements of Germans, in groups numbering in the hundreds or the thousands, continued to be made in the 19th century and well into the 20th century. The initial German settlements were in an almost deserted region where the immigrants had to clear the forest before being able to farm. Until after the middle of the 19th century, the only immigrants to Rio Grande do Sul were Germans, and it was the last quarter of the century before the inflow of all other immigrants combined outnumbered the inflow of Germans. For the period from 1844 to 1874, Germans constituted 87% of all immigrants to Rio Grande do Sul. Most of these immigrants were from Western Germany. The German colonies remained culturally German for generations and grew more by natural increase than by immigration. The sexes were roughly balanced, a sign of permanent settlement, and German farm families tended to be large. Self-contained German-speaking enclaves covered vast areas. Between 1824 and 1859, more than 20,000 Germans were brought to Brazil with Brazilian government aid in various forms. The Germans not only lived separately from the Brazilians of Portuguese ancestry, but also in a very different way of life, which showed itself in the style of their better constructed homes, the care of the land, and in the Germans' willingness to engage in hard manual labor disdained by the Portuguese. The two groups differed also in their attitudes toward education and cleanliness. In the German pioneering settlements, schools appeared in the first clearings in the woods, while most native-born Brazilians remained illiterate on into the 20th century. Private German schools were not only more numerous than government schools, but also of a higher quality. The Germans were also cleaner and healthier, better fed and better housed than the Portuguese. Immigrants in general had higher standards of health and sanitation than the Brazilians, leading to a more rapid rate of immigrant population growth, the two groups having similar numbers of children per family, but with more of the immigrant children surviving to reach adulthood. The Germans also had more skilled laborers, a fact resented by the unskilled and less prosperous Brazilians. Even though Italian, Polish, and other immigrants began arriving in large numbers during the last quarter of the 19th century, the German enclaves remained largely isolated culturally. As of 1882, the entire pioneering zone of southern Brazil was 71% German-speaking, 18% Italian-speaking, and only 10% Portuguese-speaking in a predominantly Portuguese-speaking country. The Italians, and later the Poles, likewise tended to settle in their own colonies. The German colonies were noted as places where crime was virtually non-existent, where a woman could travel safely alone through the woods. In the late 19th century, Germans from Russia began to immigrate to Brazil in large numbers. Unlike the Germans from the Reich, who tended to settle in wooded areas like those in Germany, the Volga Germans tended to settle on grasslands like those in Russia. These latter areas proved to be very unproductive in Brazil, leading many Volga Germans to re-immigrate to neighboring Argentina, where they were more successful. Indeed, Argentina's transformation from a wheat importer to one of the world's great wheat exporting nations has been credited in part to the Volga Germans, who introduced new agricultural practices and created new farm implements. Whether from Russia or from Germany, German farmers in Brazil tended to settle together, maintained their own language and customs, and resist both acculturation and assimilation into what they saw as an inferior culture. There was little intermarriage in the areas of the German colonies, even well into the 20th century, though in cities and in rural areas with more diverse populations, acculturation and assimilation were more common. But it was the German concentration, rather than the degree of urbanization as such, that was crucial. Cultural assimilation was also slow. Even as late as the 1920s, 63% of the people in the town of Blumenau spoke German as their mother tongue, and throughout the region of German concentration in southern Brazil, schools were conducted in the German language from the early 19th century until the Brazilian government put a stop to it in 1938. As late as 1940, more than half the Germans in Sao Paulo, and nearly all in Rio Grande do Sul, spoke German in their homes. The economic rise of the German colonists in Brazil was from an initially primitive existence as pioneers. Indeed, in the early years, they had to learn the crude agricultural techniques of the Portuguese Brazilians and the Aborigines in order to survive at a time when there was not sufficient capital to support more advanced methods. There was a rapid growth of output in the German colonies around the middle of the 19th century. But exhaustion of the soil over the years brought declining yields in the older colonies, and in some places the poverty and isolation also took their cultural toll in a retrogression to a way of life reminiscent of the Brazilian rural poor. However, newer colonies, established in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, were more prosperous, not only because their soils were not exhausted, but also because their access to improved transportation made the marketing of their crops easier. By and large, the German farmers prospered, creating a rural middle class, and introduced new crops such as tobacco, potatoes, rye, and wheat to Brazil. As in Russia, their land expanded well beyond that originally allotted to them by the government. Despite the presence of huge landholdings by the Creole aristocracy of Brazil, Germans were able to buy up land, in small portions each, for their own use. Other European immigrant groups as well expanded beyond the land granted in their original colonies. By the early 20th century, there were few huge estates left in the areas of southern Brazil settled by European immigrants. Even in the coffee-growing regions of the state of Sao Paulo, where the Brazilian elite owned virtually all the properties in 1905, by 1934, nearly half the coffee farms were owned by people of foreign birth. The persistence of huge landholdings and landless people in Latin America and elsewhere cannot be explained solely by the initial division of land, for small German farmers in Tsarist Russia bought out much of the landed aristocracy in the Crimea, just as their compatriots did in Brazil. It is the productivity of alternative landowners which is crucial in the long run in determining whether or not they can bid land away from current owners. German farmers in Brazil, as elsewhere around the world, were noted for their productivity. They were brought to Brazil at the Brazilian government's initiative and with subsidies precisely because the government anticipated that they could achieve the arduous task of clearing virgin forests and making agriculture viable there. The Germans were noted as people who were not reluctant to engage in physical labor nor disdainful of it, like many Portuguese Brazilians. It was this pattern of hard work, not more advanced techniques of farming, which accounted for the Germans' success in Brazil. As elsewhere around the world, Germans in Brazil were joiners. The first German club was established in Rio de Janeiro in 1830. The Germania Society was founded in Porto Alegre in 1855, followed over the years by mutual aid societies, athletic associations, photographers' clubs, singing groups, and many others. Various sports were introduced to Brazil by Germans of an athletic bent. Soccer thus became the national sport of the country. As a literate people in a largely illiterate society, the Germans produced their own newspapers and periodicals in urban centers. Publications with such names as the Santa Cruz Anzeiger, the Deutsche Zeitung, and the Brasil Post appeared in the 19th century, and a flourishing German-language press continued publishing in Brazil well into the 20th century. These newspapers, like the people they served, tended to be non-political. Government at all levels remained in the control of Brazilian landowners of Portuguese ancestry. Throughout the period up to World War I, most Germans in Brazil did not even bother to acquire Brazilian citizenship, which was easily obtainable, much less to vote. The passing years brought not only a growing prosperity to Rio Grande do Sul, but also a larger and more varied immigration, as well as an in-migration of Brazilians of Portuguese ancestry. Declining German immigration into the state toward the end of the 19th century was surpassed several times over by that of Italian immigrants, many of whom worked on the vast coffee plantations of the region owned by Brazilians. Rio Grande do Sul continued to be one of the main recipients of immigrants to Brazil up until the beginning of World War I, these new immigrants now overshadowing the Germans numerically. In 1900, Germans were only 15% of the state's population, a proportion that remained relatively stable over the years, reaching 17% by the middle of the 20th century. In absolute numbers, however, the German population of Rio Grande do Sul rose from an estimated 60,000 in 1872 to 300,000 by 1917. Although the overwhelming majority of earlier German settlers were farmers, the passing generations saw the emergence of German artisans, merchants, and industrialists. The artisans were often taught trades that their fathers brought over from Germany, but which had not been practiced in Brazil because of the pressing need to develop the pioneering farms in order to survive. These artisans initially divided their time between their respective trades and cultivation of the soil. Some, however, moved into villages or cities, opening their own one-man shops. They were well received in communities of Brazilian Portuguese ancestry. These artisans flourished in the late 19th century, but then declined with the rise of industry and the competition of Polish and especially Italian artisans. Because Germans dominated the new industrial development, it is not clear how many German artisans failed and how many advanced into industry. The first industrial firms in Rio Grande do Sul were founded by Germans in the mid-19th century. This state became the industrial heartland of Brazil, if not all of Latin America. By 1895, there were 30 corporations in Rio Grande do Sul, including 10 new industrial firms. Almost all were German. The largest employed more than 900 workers. By 1907, there were 212 industrial establishments, and by 1908, over 100 more than that. In many branches of industry, German names were the primary ones, and sometimes the only ones, as in the manufacture of metal furniture, trunks, stoves, paper, hats, neckties, leather, soap, glass, matches, beer, confections, and carriages, as well as in foundries and carpentry shops. It was said that the German community at Novo Hamburgo passed, in a little over a century, from a green forest to electrometallurgy. The growing port city of Porto Alegre, long the major outlet for the shipment of agricultural products, became also a major center of industrial and commercial activity, including international shipments of commercial and industrial products. The majority of Porto Alegre's enterprises were German. Small cigar factories were established in Porto Alegre as early as 1832, processing tobacco grown in the German colonies. Wood became one of the most important commodities in these colonies as sawmills developed in the pioneering areas. Wood was one of the major exports of Porto Alegre, with two-thirds of it being shipped by German exporters at the end of the 19th century. Commercial activity increased in the older German colonies as agriculture declined over the years. The newer colonies, whose agriculture was more prosperous, were slower to develop commercial businessmen, but finally did so, and in growing numbers. The German export business in Porto Alegre was initially tied very closely to the products of the German agricultural colonies in the area. many of these export products remained predominantly in the hands of German exporters well into the 20th century, leather, potatoes, and black beans, for example. Other products historically associated with the German colonies, sausage, ham, cheese, brandy, were increasingly exported by merchants of other ethnic groups, notably the Italians. In part, this may represent a shift of production sites, more so than growing inter-ethnic transactions. Woodwork, for example, was no longer centered in the German colonies. German importers began with strong links to the products of Germany, but they too became more diversified with the years, while rising to a dominant position among all exporters in Porto Alegre. As of 1858, less than one-fifth of that city's importers were German, but by 1890, more than half of the largest import houses were. By 1914, 96 out of 140 shipping firms in Porto Alegre were German. The movement of Germans out of their colonies, the growth of other colonies, and the general inflow of other immigrants and of Brazilians of Portuguese ancestry made some inroads into the cultural and social insularity of the Germans in Brazil. Still, as late as 1910, more than 70% of the marriages of persons of German ancestry were with others of the same ethnic background. Nevertheless, this represented an increase of mixed marriages, an increase centered in the cities or in colonies near people of other ethnic backgrounds. In the older German agricultural colony in São Leopoldo, in the center of a region still heavily populated by Germans, marriages remained almost 100% endogamous from the 1890s through the end of World War II. However, in the urban areas of São Leopoldo, endogamous marriages fell sharply from 100% in 1878 to 59% by 1906. In the city of Porto Alegre, at about the same time, the rate of mixed marriages among the German Brazilians was almost identical. World War I proved to be a disaster for the Germans in Brazil, as in other countries. From the beginning, the sympathies of most Brazilians were with the Allies, that of the Germans with their homeland. About half of the Germans belonged to the Evangelical Church, which had institutional ties to the Prussian Church, from which they received most of their clergy and some of their money. The Evangelicals not only offered prayers for Germany's success in the war, but also raised money for the German Red Cross and bought German war bonds. This was not true of the German Catholics, nor was it true of those German Lutherans whose subsidies came from the Missouri Synod in the United States. Nevertheless, Germans as a whole were seen as pro-Germany in a country that was pro-Allies. Moreover, the Germans were a people whose prosperity and exclusivity were already resented. Finally, the Germans inadvertently hurt their own cause in 1916 by organizing a short-lived group called the Germanische Bund für Südamerika, a chauvinistic organization which provoked counter-chauvinism among other Brazilians. The spark which set off this explosive atmosphere came in April 1917, when a German submarine torpedoed and sank a Brazilian ship off the coast of France. Riots broke out in several Brazilian cities, with violence, arson, and looting aimed at German businesses and homes. 6 months later, another Brazilian ship was torpedoed by a German submarine, setting off another series of riots in Rio de Janeiro and other Brazilian cities. Brazil declared war on Germany, and while that had little practical meaning internationally, few Brazilians actually fought in Europe, it had great impact on the Germans in Brazil. Under its special wartime powers, the Brazilian government imposed a military occupation in some German areas and closed down German-language newspapers and hundreds of German-language schools. Because of a lack of public schools in many areas where Germans were settled, this meant that thousands of children were simply deprived of education during the war. Many of these schools never reopened. German business firms were blacklisted. Many German organizations changed their names or dissolved. After the end of World War I, restrictions were lifted and life returned to normal, though there were lasting resentments among the Germans in Brazil, resentments later exploited by Nazi agents in the 1930s. During the 1920s, when economic conditions were dire and chaotic in Germany, a huge new inflow of German immigration reached Brazil, nearly 76,000 German immigrants, by far the most in any decade of the country's history. They joined a German community that was once again prosperous and was becoming more and more a part of Brazil's cultural and social life. In 1920, more than half the leather products factories in the state of Rio Grande do Sul were owned by Germans or Brazilians of German ancestry. Moreover, the top 15 German firms of that era produced twice as much leather as the top 14 firms owned by Brazilians of Portuguese ancestry. Firms owned by people of Italian rather than Portuguese ancestry provided the main competition to the Germans in many industrial areas. 60% of the firms producing alcoholic beverages were German, with most of the remainder being Italian. About two-thirds of the tinware in the state was produced by 9 German firms. More than two-thirds of the nails, neckties, and dresses, and all of the chocolate and products of glassworks came from German firms. Yet, Germans were a little more than one-fifth the population of the state. All industrial machinery in Brazil was imported when the Germans built the first starch mill in Santa Catarina in the 1920s, but by the 1930s, a second starch mill was equipped with machines made in Brazil by German immigrant engineers. The post-war resurgence of the prestige of Germans was perhaps symbolized by the 1924 centenary celebration of the founding of the German colony and the government's expression of recognition of their contributions to Brazil. There were also more tangible signs of how Germans had prospered in Brazil. When a country club was built in Porto Alegre in 1930, 40% of its members were of German ancestry. The rise of the Nazis to power in Germany in 1933 set in motion a chain of events which again compromised the position of Germans in Brazil. Nazis infiltrated most of the numerous German organizations in Brazil during the 1930s. The Nazi network was complete with its own secret police to take note of those opposed to Nazism, or even the hesitators. Such people were subjected to boycotts and ostracism locally, and their relatives in Germany were subject to reprisals. A few brave individuals and organizations in the German community publicly opposed the Nazis, but Germans as a group were perceived by other Brazilians as pro-Nazi. The Brazilian government took strong countermeasures in the late 1930s. The 1937 Constitution forbade all political activity, and in 1938, all private schools in the nation were nationalized. As of 1937, there were more than 2,000 private schools in the German colonies. Over a period of 50 years, the Brazilian government had built only 30 schools, but now they built more than 100 in 5 years, mostly in the German colonies. Still, these were small numbers by comparison with what had already existed there. These formerly private schools were now conducted in the Portuguese language and with a Brazilian orientation. These changes were decisive for the acculturation of a new generation of Germans in Brazil. World War II brought a new set of restrictions reminiscent of those in the previous war. German language publications were prohibited, as was the speaking of German in public. German libraries were destroyed and German gun clubs disarmed. Some elements of the Brazilian police took advantage of the situation to commit violence and extortion. Once again, the torpedoing of a Brazilian ship by a German submarine set off arson and looting against German businesses in Porto Alegre. During the war, young German men served in the Brazilian military, being exposed to the larger society and to regions of the country they might not have seen otherwise. The post-war world saw not merely a return to normalcy, but further progress toward acculturation and integration into Brazilian society. Long apathetic about politics, Germans began to elect more deputies than ever in the post-war elections. While the rate of endogamous marriages remained high in most German agricultural settlements in the early post-war years, averaging 72%, in some towns and cities it dropped near or below 50%. In the city of Porto Alegre, endogamous marriages among Brazilians of German descent fell to 39% by 1949. At the other extreme, in the agricultural district of Teutonia, 100% of all marriages remained endogamous. The key role of the Germans in the industrial development of Brazil remained apparent in the post-war era. In the middle of the 20th century, nearly half of the industrial enterprises in the southern Brazilian states were owned by people of German ancestry. The German contribution is one reason why the southern Brazilian states became the industrial heartland of the country, as well as containing the most advanced agriculture. Indeed, Sao Paulo has been called the industrial giant of Latin America. Paraguay. The landlocked nation of Paraguay, nestled between Argentina and Brazil, with Bolivia on its northern border, attracted relatively few immigrants, officially about 67,000 for the entire period from 1881 to 1958. Nearly one-fifth of these immigrants were German Mennonites, but there were also other colonies of Germans who were not Mennonites. German and other immigrant colonies began to be set up in the second half of the 19th century, as Paraguay sought to attract immigration because of its small and declining population. There were fewer than a quarter of a million inhabitants of Paraguay in 1872, less than one-third as many people as in 1865. A disastrous war had decimated its population. Foreigners were sought not only for numbers, but also because of the skills and education desperately needed by the population of Paraguay, whose more cultured classes had long ago been suppressed or exiled under an anti-elitist dictatorship from 1814 to 1840. The German colony established in 1881 was not the first foreign colony in Paraguay, but it was the first to succeed and become an enduring settlement. Germans had been in Paraguay before these colonies were founded, but as individuals. There were Germans among the early Spanish explorers and conquerors. During a century and a half of Jesuit mission colonies in Paraguay, there were also Germans among the Jesuits, and these Germans often had skills and education lacking in their Spanish brethren, skills which improved the agriculture, health, and construction available to the Native American Indians. One authority described the contribution of these German Jesuits as the biggest cultural achievement of the Germans in South America during the 17th and 18th centuries. German colonies continued to be set up well into the 20th century. Many of these Germans came not only from Germany, but also from Russia, from German colonies in Africa, from Canada, and even from Samoa. Among the contributions of Germans over the centuries were the introduction of the plow during the Jesuit colony era, participation in the creation of the first sugar manufacturing plant, cattle breeding improvements, replanting of the yerba trees in deforested areas, creation of a wine industry, and the development of a vast and barren region of western Paraguay called the Chaco, long thought to be impossible to farm. The Chaco was quickly settled by a number of Mennonite villages in the late 1920s, despite many hardships and deaths. Some Mennonites returned to Canada, some moved into the more developed eastern part of Paraguay, but others remained and made this forbidding area more viable. As in other areas of the Western Hemisphere, the German settlers in the Chaco tended to take a more conciliatory approach to the Native American Indians in the area. Ironically, they thereby lost the respect of these Paraguayan Indians, who had been used to harsher treatment from whites. In Paraguay, as elsewhere around the world, German settlers established their own schools at their own expense. The first of these schools was built in 1889, and it was still in existence in the latter half of the 20th century. There were 11 German schools in Paraguay by 1914, and on the eve of World War II, there were 70 German schools, which provided a German education to an estimated 90% of the German children of school age. However, the relatively small German population of Paraguay, living largely in scattered agricultural colonies, was unable to sustain its own newspapers until after the First World War. Before then, they obtained from Argentina the Argentinische Tageblatt and other German papers. During the mid-1920s, however, the Deutsche Zeitung für Paraguay was published three times a week, and other German-language periodical literature developed. The largest minority in Paraguay, aside from the Native American Indians, Germans maintained their cultural and social isolation in Paraguay on into the late 1930s. This isolation has been particularly characteristic of the large Mennonite element, which likewise isolated itself in Russia, Canada, Mexico, and elsewhere. Paraguay, with its once dire shortage of population, had agreed to granting the Mennonites the religious and educational autonomy they sought, together with exemption from military service. In addition, Paraguay had less stringent immigration requirements than some alternative destinations, such as Canada and Brazil. The people and the country apparently met each other's needs. New German colonies continued to be set up in Paraguay after World War II. Mennonite refugees from the Soviet Union fled first to Germany and then to Paraguay, when they feared being captured and sent back to the USSR. Paraguay offered them the same religious freedom and guarantees for their own way of life which it had offered to others before them. The new Mennonite colonies encountered many of the same hardships as earlier ones, but now international humanitarian agencies and connections with Mennonites in Canada enabled some to leave, most for Canada, some for Brazil, and a few returning to Germany. Paraguayans adopted some of the farming methods of the Mennonites, and Paraguayan laborers often worked for them, but they remained otherwise separate people. Intermarriage has been quite rare. In a world where few things have been so dangerous to ethnic minorities as high productivity, the appreciation of the Germans by Paraguay is a notable exception. Perhaps their isolation has reduced envy and minimized the opportunities for political claims of exploitation of others. Australia. There were some Germans among the earliest European settlers in Australia in the late 18th century. By the early 19th century, individual Germans were farmers, merchants, and vintners in Australia. In addition to establishing some of the earliest vineyards in the country, Germans also produced a light beer to replace British ale and stout. Many 19th century Germans settled in Australia, not as individuals but in groups. The first of these German settlements was made in 1838, marking also the first settlement of a large non-British group in the country. Despite a voyage of 3 months or more to Australia, at a time when the United States could be reached in a matter of weeks, German immigration to Australia continued, though not on a scale comparable to that in the Western Hemisphere. However, as of 1861, Germans were the third largest group in Australia, after people of British and Chinese ancestry, though in absolute numbers there were still only about 27,000 Germans. By 1891, however, the Germans had passed the Chinese and numbered 45,000 people, or just over half the total European-born immigrant population. Australia is a vast country, about the size of the continental United States, and the degree to which Germans formed separate communities in Australia varied considerably from region to region. This was in part related to the degree of urbanization and the ratio between the sexes among Germans in different areas. Overall, there was a surplus of males, but it was not so extreme as to suggest a predominantly temporary or exploratory migration. As of 1861, there were more than twice as many male as female immigrants from Germany, but by 1881, there were less than twice as many. The sexes were closest to being balanced in the state of South Australia, where there were 82 female immigrants for every 100 male immigrants as early as 1861. Here, there were isolated German-speaking enclaves in which the food, customs, and even style of houses reproduced the life of Silesian peasant communities. However, in the gold fields in the state of Victoria, Germans were much more part of a general melting pot. In the 1840s and 1850s, several German villages were established in South Australia's Barossa Valley, perhaps still the best-known German settlement area in Australia in the late 20th century. The first settlements were crude, featuring thatched-roofed cottages with dirt floors arranged along a single road in a typical German manner. However, there were many people with such skills as carpentry, masonry, cabinet-making, shoemaking, and tailoring, so these homes grew more comfortable as the villages thrived with the passing years. Still, the style of house, the furnishings and utensils, as well as the population of these farm communities, remained entirely German. The tombstones from that era are inscribed entirely in German. A visitor from Germany in 1851 declared, "The traveler would believe himself in some little village of the old country between the Rhine and the Oder." The first German language newspaper in Australia was published in the city of Adelaide in 1848 and continued to be published there in the late 20th century. A very different picture was presented in the state of Victoria, where the lopsided sex ratio, nearly four times as many German men as German women in 1857, militated against separate German enclaves. Given the very unbalanced sex ratio among Germans in Victoria, it is hardly surprising that they had a high rate of intermarriage. The fact that Germans were a very small fraction of the population throughout Victoria, perhaps 2% overall, and only about 7% in the areas of their strongest concentration, likewise tended to encourage both intermarriage and acculturation. The situation in the state of New South Wales was much like that in Victoria. Moreover, German immigrants to New South Wales increasingly settled in metropolitan and other urban areas, making those in the rural areas a minority as early as 1881. These were not conditions that made for the preservation of a German culture. With the exception of rural groups, most of the 9,600 Germans in New South Wales in 1891 were soon absorbed into the general population. The state of Queensland, on the other hand, followed a pattern more like that of South Australia. There were more than two-thirds as many German female immigrants as German male immigrants in 1881. Most of these immigrants came in family groups, and the majority settled in rural areas. Queensland became a major area of German settlement. In 1891, almost one-third of all German immigrants to Australia settled in Queensland. However, the Germans in Queensland were more diverse in their regional origins and dialects in Germany than were the Germans of South Australia. Most of the 19th century immigration from Germany was from the Protestant eastern and central regions, and largely ended in the 1880s. Although Germans in Australia were overwhelmingly Lutheran, they were split into two main Lutheran factions, which differed culturally as well as theologically. The United Evangelical Lutheran Church maintained ties to Germany, from which many of its pastors came, speaking German and consciously maintaining the German language and culture in Australia. The other major faction, the Evangelical Lutheran Synod of Australia, developed ties to the Missouri Synod in the United States. By the 1890s, its many English-speaking pastors from the United States tended to make the latter group less resistant to cultural assimilation. On the whole, Germans in Australia were slow to take on the culture of the surrounding society. Although it was relatively easy to become naturalized in 19th century Australia, most Germans did not become citizens. They tended to maintain strong ties with each other, rather than with the surrounding society. In all the colonies, Germans were joiners, forming associations, or Vereine. As the Deutsche Australische Post said in 1893, "Where there are two Germans, they form a Verein, but where there are four Germans, they establish two Vereine." These clubs, associations, newspapers, and above all the Lutheran Church, kept German culture alive for generations, for at least some of the Germans in Australia, though to highly varying degrees by region. While South Australian Germans remained thoroughly German for at least a century, Germans in Sydney were noted for becoming Anglicized. As early as 1893, a visitor from Germany claimed that his countrymen in Sydney believed only in God and the Sydney Morning Herald. Even where German clubs existed in Australia, they were by no means always restricted to Germans. Some of the German associations in Melbourne and Adelaide had substantial numbers of non-German members. As in Russia, the United States, and other parts of the world, the Germans in Australia were not very active politically. There were some German political figures in 19th century Australia, but even in South Australia, their numbers were very small, and not in excess of the German proportion of the population. Some represented predominantly German constituencies, but others represented constituencies in which their compatriots were a small minority. By and large, Germans in Australia have historically been underrepresented in politics. In Australia, as in other countries, Germans became known for hard work, thoroughness, honesty, thrift, sobriety, reliability, and respect for laws. As in other countries, the rural German settlers were noted as successful farmers. There were often pioneers on virgin land who had to create their own communities, schools, and cultural life in general, and maintain strong solidarity and cooperation. Education was one of their commitments. As of the turn of the century, there were 46,000 Lutheran schools in South Australia alone. The Lutheran Church was the dominant religious and cultural influence, for few German Catholics immigrated to Australia. Approximately one-third of the German immigrants to Australia were farmers, slightly more were tradesmen, and only 12% were laborers. The wide range of skills among them enabled them to set up villages and even small towns as self-sufficient German enclaves. The German language was retained in many communities until at least the beginning of the First World War. Scattered evidence indicates that intermarriage was the exception rather than the rule in the 19th century, but it became more common in the early decades of the 20th century. Similarly, although most Germans in the 19th century did not become Australian citizens, by 1921 a majority did. World War I dealt a blow to Germans in Australia, as elsewhere. About 4,000 of the 33,000 Germans in Australia at that time were interned, some under brutal conditions. German language schools were closed. The German language press was also restricted in what it could report, and there was in general a reduced use of the German language, as well as a replacement by the Australian government of local German place names with names of English origin and of significance in British history. Muller Park in Western Australia became Kitchener Park, for example. However, some of these names were later changed back. Demagogic attacks on the entire German community were made by a number of politicians, some proposing to take away their basic rights. In part, such reactions were the culmination of a growing unease over the years among the Australians, replacing their earlier acceptance and enthusiasm for the German immigrants. This pre-war change in attitudes among Australians reflected changing attitudes among Germans in Australia due to the rise of pan-German doctrines. There were evidences of divided loyalty among Germans in Australia, especially after the unification of Germany in 1871 and its spectacular rise in economic achievement and military strength. A number of public embarrassments revealed the difficulty which many Germans in Australia had in reconciling their pride in their culture and fatherland with their role as citizens of another country. German language newspapers made their appearance in Australia in the 19th century. The largest of these was the Australische Zeitung, published in Adelaide, near the center of the Australian-German cultural stronghold. However, even this region was not impervious to the forces of cultural assimilation. When a new clubhouse was opened in 1913 in Tanunda, also in the German heartland of South Australia, all the speeches for the occasion were in English. The United Evangelical Lutheran Protestant Church, the strongest bastion of German culture, began to offer services, confirmation, and Sunday school instruction in English, though only gradually. It was 1930 before about half of the United Lutheran Church services in Australia were given in English, and it was 8 years later before half of those in South Australia as a whole were in English. Most Sunday school instruction and confirmations were in English earlier, perhaps reflecting the greater acculturation of the younger generation, though even here it was 1937 before half the South Australian United Evangelical Lutheran Churches offered these services in English. The 1930s saw an infiltration of German organizations in Australia by Nazi agents, following a pattern found also in the United States, Brazil, Southwest Africa, and elsewhere. Blackmail against people with relatives in Germany was part of a Nazi pattern, in Australia as elsewhere. The Evangelical Lutheran Church rebuffed Nazi efforts, and the United Evangelical Lutheran Church disavowed the Nazi ideology, but the latter's actions were more ambiguous, and parts of the Nazi vision, including anti-Semitism, appeared in church publications. Nevertheless, when war came, it urged its members to fight for Australia and to cooperate with Australian authorities. Once again, as in World War I, there were restrictions on what enemy aliens could do or where they could be. However, very few Australians of German ancestry were interned. Even in South Australia, there were only 27 Australians of German ancestry interned out of 30,000, though 88 German citizens were interned there, and 350 German aliens nationally. In the post-war world, Germans continued to immigrate to Australia and to prosper. From 1947 to 1969, 83,000 immigrants from Germany arrived in Australia. Most had their immigration subsidized by the Australian government. These post-war German immigrants differed significantly from the immediate pre-war German immigrants. Refugees from the Nazis, including a high proportion of professional people, predominated in the immediate pre-war immigration from Germany, while the post-war immigrants were a broader cross-section of the German population. Relations between those who fled Nazi Germany and those who remained there until after the war were reportedly politely reserved in Australia. In addition to immigrants from Germany, the post-war German immigration has also included ethnic Germans from Hungary, Romania, and Yugoslavia. Although resident outside Germany in some cases for centuries, these ethnic Germans, like those from Russia or in parts of Latin America, have often remained German in language and culture. Another component of the German population in Australia consisted of German nationals working for such multinational corporations as Volkswagen, Daimler-Benz, Bayer, and others. One area of Australia in which the post-war immigration has been studied in some detail is the Latrobe Valley of Victoria, a long-established dairying and then mining and industrial center. Germans were among a number of post-war immigrant groups settling there among a predominantly Australian-born population. For the valley as a whole, the immigration from Germany was 13% more male than female in 1954, and for Victoria as a whole, only 3% more male. Most of the Germans were Lutheran, had no kin in Australia, but immigrated with financial assistance from the Australian government. After an average of 5 years' residence in Australia, less than one-fifth were unskilled laborers, next to the lowest proportion among all the immigrant groups. The lowest proportion was among immigrants from the Baltic, who may include, or even be predominantly, Baltic Germans. The wages of immigrants from Germany in the Latrobe Valley were exceeded only by those of immigrants from Great Britain and the Baltic, the latter groups averaging several years longer residence in Australia. Just over half the German immigrants owned an automobile, putting them well ahead of most other immigrants in that regard. As for assimilation, about half the German immigrants in the Latrobe Valley spoke only German in their homes, more than a third spoke both German and English there, and less than one-sixth spoke mainly English at home. Most continued to read German-language publications, mainly from overseas, and 38% reported that friends who visited them were mainly German. While 40% reported that their visitors were both Australians and immigrants, only 11% reported that their visitors were mainly Australian. Nevertheless, there was little evidence that these post-war German immigrants intended to establish exclusive German enclaves in the manner of some earlier immigrants from Germany. Most of the post-war German immigrants in the Latrobe Valley did not teach German to their children. A similar pattern was found among German immigrants in the state of Western Australia. Here, too, parents did not speak German exclusively at home, and the children, in fact, usually became proficient in English. Less than half the families stuck to German eating patterns, and very few limited their social contacts to other Germans. Many of these post-war Germans came to Australia to sever their ties with a past that they wanted to forget, whether that past was World War II, Nazism, or Soviet occupation. For the post-war German immigrants as a whole, more than 90% spoke English, including 42% who spoke only English. These post-war German immigrants in Western Australia seemed to be on their way to a much speedier and more thorough assimilation than their 19th-century predecessors. The number of Germans in Australia in the late 20th century varies according to the definitions used, whether German nationals, German-born Australians, or Australians of full or partial German ancestry. By the most stringent definition, there were more than 110,000 persons in Australia who were born in Germany. By the most relaxed definition, there were estimated to be well over 1 million Australians with some degree of German ancestry. By a more reasonable estimate of ethnic origin, there were approximately 581,000 Germans in Australia, and they were approximately 4% of the Australian population. Official data, however, were available only for those born in Germany. By 1979, German-born males in Australia averaged 13% higher income than Australian males. German immigrants achieved higher education more often than the Australian population as a whole, and were unemployed less often than the general population. Implications. A number of cultural characteristics have recurred or persisted for generations or even centuries among Germans, whether living in their homeland or in highly disparate societies around the world. The capacity of Germans for hard, thorough, unrelenting work has been noted in Germany itself, as well as in colonial America, Tsarist Russia, Honduras, Australia, Brazil, Ireland, Argentina, and Paraguay. A counterpoint to this zeal for work has been an apathy about politics, which has long been endemic in Germany itself and in the German states and principalities that preceded it, as well as among German communities overseas. Along with this political apathy has gone a great deference to authorities, expressed in many ways, not only in Germany, but also in other lands where Germans have loyally served their adopted countries, even in wars against their ancestral homeland. Exceptions have occurred in countries which actively pursued anti-German policies internally, notably in such Eastern European nations as the Soviet Union and Czechoslovakia. Both the strong German military tradition and anti-military tradition have deep roots in Germany and have followed Germans around the world. The German respect for education is likewise a centuries-old phenomenon in Germany, which pioneered in modern educational developments from the kindergarten to the university. German emigrants have made education an important priority, even in countries where those around them have remained uneducated and unconcerned about education. Loyalty to the German language and culture, while living in other countries, has seldom meant loyalty to the German government. However, both Imperial Germany and the Third Reich attempted to manipulate Germans living in foreign countries for national political advantage, and usually to the detriment of those German communities. Often the cultures to which Germans remained loyal were regional or local cultures, so that Palatine communities were recreated in upstate New York, or Silesian villages in parts of Australia, or Volga or Black Sea communities when Germans from Russia resettled in the Western Hemisphere. The local and regional nature of these cultures was exemplified in the local and regional dialects spoken by immigrants from different areas. The various regional dialects of German spoken in the many enclaves in the United States, for example, not only differed from one another, but sometimes persisted after such dialects had begun to die out in Germany itself. Moreover, German communities consisting of people who immigrated from countries outside the Reich tended to speak not only a particular dialect derived from their regional ancestral speech in Germany, but also words and expressions from the Romanian, Hungarian, Russian, or Ukrainian languages in the respective countries from which they immigrated to the United States, Canada, or elsewhere. In short, German cultural persistence overseas was generally more a matter of clinging to the familiar rather than political nationalism. Where German community solidarity did take a political form, such as support for Germany during the two world wars, the backlash which this provoked in the surrounding societies often ranged from social ostracism to economic blacklisting, repressive laws, internment, mob violence, and in Eastern Europe after the Second World War, mass expulsions. The dozen years of Germany's history dominated by the Nazis cast a long shadow over Germans, at home and abroad, for decades after the Hitler regime was buried in the dust and rubble at the end of World War II. While the Nazi movement exploited certain features of German culture, including obedience to authority and a romanticizing of power and violence, in other ways, the Nazis represented a sharp break with the more civilized aspects of German tradition. For example, the racial fanaticism of the Nazi era in Germany was in sharp contrast with the historic, tolerant cosmopolitanism of Germans in the Baltic and Czechoslovakia, or the German anti-slavery position in Brazil and the United States, their ability to get along with the indigenous American Indians in the Western Hemisphere, their charitable efforts toward the Aborigines in Australia, and the widespread acceptance, including intermarriage, of Jews in pre-Hitler Germany. Group prejudice and discrimination were by no means unknown among Germans, at home or abroad, but it tended to be less rather than more prevalent as compared to other Europeans, or to Asians or Africans, for that matter. The economic achievements of Germans were fundamental to the rise of Germany as a world power and to the agricultural and industrial progress of other nations with substantial contingents of German immigrants. The outstanding records of the Germans in family farming around the world in the 18th and 19th centuries was matched by their later achievements in science and technology. Even the particular industries in which they have historically been outstanding pioneers, brewing, optics, pianos, and industrial manufacturing, for example, have been reproduced among Germans in widely scattered countries. While Germans abroad have been notable for their loyalty to the respective countries in which they settled, they have nevertheless suffered from Germany's actions in two world wars. The First World War led to the suppression of the German language and culture in the Western Hemisphere and Australia, while World War II brought the mass deportation of Germans from the European to the Asiatic regions of the USSR. The atrocities committed by the Nazis during their occupation of Eastern Europe and the Balkans came back to haunt the ethnic Germans of that region. Post-war realignments of borders were accompanied by expulsions of 15 million ethnic Germans, many of whom had family roots going back for centuries in Poland, Hungary, the Sudetenland of Czechoslovakia, and other parts of Eastern Europe, as well as in eastern regions of Germany, which now became part of Poland, as eastern portions of Poland became part of the Soviet Union. The embittered peoples of the region, who had suffered from the Nazi occupation, with which local ethnic Germans often collaborated, now took their revenge on Germans in general, with atrocities that contributed to the deaths of 2 million of these German expellees. Winston Churchill, whose opposition to the Nazi regime began long before the war began, nevertheless spoke of mass expulsions of millions of Germans on a scale grievous and undreamed of, and said, "We must banish revenge against an entire race from our minds." The horrors of Hitler and the Nazis continued to be associated with Germany and with Germans long after World War II, reducing the world influence of the economically vibrant West German nation, even after the passing decades produced a German population largely born since the end of the Nazi era, including increasingly people whose parents had not yet been born at the time of Hitler. However, decades of peaceful coexistence and the development of democratic traditions in West Germany eventually allayed the fears of surrounding nations sufficiently to lead to widespread international acceptance of a reunited Germany in 1990. In the long view of history, few peoples have made such cultural and economic contributions to so many lands in so many parts of the planet as the Germans.